It's really a pleasure to be back here in my hometown of Philadelphia and to be invited to speak here tonight at the Global Interdependence Center and the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. I think the GIC has a very impressive history of promoting the public dialogue about monetary policy and about other topics, and it's a privilege to be able to participate in that. So tonight I'm going to focus my comments on the implementation of the recent monetary policy decisions of the Federal Reserve and on the associated implications that they've had for its balance sheet. As always, the views I'm going to express are my own and don't represent those of the FOMC or the Federal Reserve System. So in the second half of 2010, the FOMC made two important policy decisions about the size and composition of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. In August, it decided to begin reinvesting the principal payments from its holdings of agency debt and mortgage-backed securities and reinvesting them into longer-term Treasury securities in order to keep the amount of domestic assets held in the SOMA portfolio unchanged at $2 trillion. In November, as you know, the FOMC announced its intention to expand the SOMA portfolio by purchasing an additional $600 billion of longer-term Treasury securities through the end of the second quarter of this year, bringing the intended level of domestic securities holdings to $2.6 trillion. Those decisions were aimed at providing more monetary policy stimulus to the economy. The FOMC saw the additional stimulus as warranted because it viewed the progress towards its mandated objectives of full employment and price stability as disappointingly slow. In effect, the committee was using the size and composition of its balance sheet as a policy instrument, given that it had already employed its traditional means of policy easing by decreasing short-term interest rates to the fullest extent possible. Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke has noted that the intention of asset purchases is similar to that associated with changes in short-term interest rates, in that they are meant to affect economic activity by influencing broader financial conditions. But while the intention of the recent policy decisions may be similar to traditional monetary policy adjustments, the implementation of them is not. These policy decisions involve what are presumably some of the largest and most rapid portfolio adjustments that have ever taken place by any single financial market participant. To put it in perspective, note that these recent policy decisions involve the Federal Reserve purchasing over an 8-month period more Treasury securities than the amount currently held by the entire U.S. commercial banking system. It's therefore no small task to determine how to implement these purchases in an effective and responsible manner. That task falls to the Open Market Trading Desk at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which I'll refer to as the desk, which is a part of the markets group that I run at the bank. So let me describe how the desk has conducted these purchases and some of the issues that we've taken into consideration during the process. So a good place to start is with the distinction between the roles of the FOMC and the desk. The FOMC is responsible for making monetary policy decisions, while the desk is responsible for implementing those policy actions on behalf of the FOMC. Thus, decisions about the broad parameters of an asset purchase program, such as the amount of securities to be purchased or the duration of those securities, those reside with the FOMC, as those are the parameters that will govern the overall impact on financial conditions and ultimately on the economy. The role of the desk is to determine how best to carry out the purchase program within those broad parameters. In doing so, the desk seeks to meet the policy intentions of the FOMC while taking into consideration two other objectives. The first objective is to obtain the securities at competitive and appropriate prices for the Federal Reserve, as doing so will ultimately benefit the U.S. taxpayer. The second objective is to minimize any negative effects that the purchases may have on the functioning of financial markets. As I noted in a speech in October 2010, the liquidity and efficiency of the Treasury market provide tremendous benefits to our economy, and the desk was intent on designing a purchase program that would not diminish those benefits in any meaningful way. To achieve these objectives, the desk relies on a system in which it purchases securities through reverse auctions with a set of established counterparties called the primary dealers. The securities that are eligible for each operation and an indication of the total size of the operation are announced in advance. Dealers then submit offers to sell those securities, either from their own accounts or on behalf of their customers, over a 45-minute period on the morning of the operation. Those offers are assessed by the desk based on two criteria: their proximity to market prices at that time, and an internal methodology for comparing the relative value of the securities at the offered prices. This process occurs over a proprietary trading system called FedTrade under the oversight of the desk staff, and the results are typically finalized and published within a few minutes of the close of the operation. So with this infrastructure, the desk has been able to purchase large volumes of securities in a rapid manner, as required by the policy decisions made by the FOMC. Indeed, over the period since the FOMC's decision to expand the portfolio, the desk has purchased about $300 billion of Treasury securities. That total includes about $220 billion of purchases out of the intended $600 billion expansion of the portfolio, and another $80 billion of purchases associated with the reinvestment of principal payments on agency debt and mortgage-backed securities. In terms of the monthly pace, the purchases so far have been running at about $105 billion per month, consisting of roughly $75 billion in new investments and $30 billion of reinvestments. To meet this pace, the desk has been operating in the market on nearly every available day. The operations to date have gone well. Participation by the dealers has been strong, with an average offer to cover ratio of about 3.5, and the accepted offers have been allocated across a number of dealers and a wide range of securities. Given the robust participation in the operations, the desk has received competitive and appropriate prices for the securities obtained. Moreover, our purchases do not appear to be causing significant strains on the liquidity or functioning of the Treasury market. It is unusual for the market to have such a large, persistent, and one-sided participant, and we had to worry about how it would adjust to our presence. However, the available evidence suggests that market liquidity has remained decent at this time. Measures of liquidity, such as trading volumes, bid-ask spreads, or quote sizes, worsened in December, but that pattern appeared to be driven by year-end effects rather than our presence in the market. These measures have recovered since the year-end, moving back towards the levels observed before the start of the purchases. In addition, we do not see signs that the market is facing unusual scarcity of particular Treasury securities. So to monitor this, we look at the number of issues trading special in the repo market and at the amounts and composition of the securities that the market borrows from our securities lending facility. Both measures have increased some, but we do not see their current levels as indicating notable strains. Moreover, it does not appear that these patterns are more acute in securities for which the SOMA portfolio holds a larger proportion of the supply. Our success at purchasing such large volumes without causing significant market strains reflects some of the operational decisions that were made in the design of the program. One key issue was determining an appropriate speed for purchasing assets. The pace of purchases under the announced plan reflects a judgment by the desk that it could purchase as much as $100 to $125 billion per month without significantly disrupting the functioning and liquidity of the Treasury market. So far, that appears to be the case, given the evidence just described. Another important aspect of the operations is the flexibility in terms of the securities that we purchase. As noted earlier, our selection of the specific offers to accept at a given operation depends on our assessment of their relative attractiveness. This process should support market functioning. In particular, it allows the market to determine which securities it is willing to sell on the most favorable terms to us. If a particular security is scarce in the market, we will presumably not be shown offers at attractive prices, and hence we will not end up removing additional supply of that security. The flexibility of this procedure can be seen in the pattern of our purchases over time. Early in the program, we ended up purchasing a large concentration of off-the-run securities, including bonds that were issued 15 to 25 years ago. Given their age, These bonds are generally less liquid and less valuable to market participants, and hence dealers were willing to sell them to us at cheaper prices relative to other securities. At more recent operations, however, we have received a greater share of offers to sell more recently issued Treasury securities, including on-the-run issues, and our purchases have shifted accordingly. This suggests that older off-the-run securities may have become harder for dealers to obtain, and that they have increasingly found it appealing to offer more recent issues, which are available in larger supply and are generally more liquid. Our procedure allows this shift to take place as long as the more recent issues are offered to us on generally favorable terms. Overall, the desk has endeavored to implement the FOMC's policy decisions in a manner that ensures competitive and appropriate prices for the securities obtained and that maintains the efficient functioning of financial markets. I believe that we have managed to accomplish these objectives with our operations to date. Of course, the operational objectives just discussed do not speak to the broader policy objectives of the asset purchase programs. The policy decisions made by the FOMC in August and November were intended to influence financial conditions in a manner that would support the economic recovery and return employment and inflation over time to levels consistent with the FOMC's objectives. One way that this might occur is through a portfolio balance channel. Under this view, removing duration from the market would keep longer-term real interest rates lower than they otherwise would be and would encourage investors to move into other types of assets, thereby making broader financial conditions more accommodative. These intended effects were apparent in financial markets from mid-August to early November, when investors increasingly anticipated the Federal Reserve's decision to expand its balance sheet. Over that period, longer-term real interest rates declined, break-even inflation rates moved up towards more normal levels, equity prices rose notably, and risk spreads on many credit instruments narrowed. This configuration of asset prices is the pattern that is typically associated with additional monetary policy easing. Since early November, one of the notable developments in financial markets has been the sharp increase in long-term interest rates. At first glance, this change may seem at odds with the portfolio balance channel. However, it is important to understand the factors that led to this increase in interest rates in the current circumstances. The upward movement in longer-term interest rates in large part reflects the greater optimism among investors about the outlook for economic growth. Investors have revised up their baseline forecasts for the economy and reduced the downside risks that they see around that outlook. This shift in the outlook led the market to price in the possibility of earlier increases in short-term interest rates and to scale back the size of asset purchases that they expected from the Federal Reserve. Both of those developments contributed to the significant rise in yields. In contrast, the rise in yields does not appear to be driven by the concerns expressed by some that the asset purchase program would unleash a considerable rise in U.S. inflation and inflation expectations to levels above those consistent with the Federal Reserve's mandate. Such an outcome would be detrimental to the economic outlook, leading to downward pressure on risky asset prices and a substantial weakening in the value of the dollar. However, what has taken place in U.S. markets to date does not resemble this outcome. Indeed, over the period since the November FOMC meeting, longer-term inflation expectations have remained at levels consistent with the Federal Reserve's mandate, risky asset prices have advanced, and the dollar has held its ground. Overall, the broad improvement in financial conditions since last summer has been an important and encouraging development. Risky asset prices such as equities have risen at a rapid pace, and credit spreads and measures of credit availability have continued to ease. These changes have been driven to a large extent by the improvement in the economic outlook, and in turn will help to promote the economic recovery going forward. The decisions in the second half of 2010 affecting the size of the Federal Reserve's portfolio have provided support to that process. To be sure, economic fundamentals will ultimately exert the strongest influence on financial conditions, as can be seen by the rise in Treasury yields, even as the Federal Reserve expanded its balance sheet. But the Federal Reserve's balance sheet actions have helped to make broader financial conditions more accommodative. Let me now shift gears a bit and talk about some of the characteristics of the SOMA portfolio. The set of asset purchase programs launched by the Federal Reserve, including those initiated at the peak of the financial crisis and the more recent actions, have changed some of the basic characteristics of the SOMA portfolio. So I thought it'd be useful to review those changes and to discuss their implications for the conduct of monetary policy. The most obvious effect of the purchase programs has been on the size of the SOMA portfolio. If the intended asset purchases announced in November are completed, the size of the domestic portfolio will reach approximately $2.6 trillion by mid-year, considerably larger than the $1 trillion portfolio that would be in place in the absence of the asset purchase programs. In addition, the purchase programs have affected the duration of the portfolio. The securities that have been purchased by the desk since November have had an average duration of about 5.5 years. With those purchases and the adjustments from the earlier purchase programs, the duration of the overall SOMA portfolio has reached about 4.5 years, which is somewhat higher than the typical level of between 2 and 3 years that was observed before the financial crisis. This combination of its larger size and longer duration results in a greater amount of interest rate risk embedded in the SOMA portfolio. Of course, under the view that asset purchase programs operate through a portfolio balance channel, this is precisely how the programs have an effect on the economy, by transferring risk away from private investors and onto the Fed's books. The risks to the portfolio arise because the characteristics of the assets that have been purchased differ from those of the liabilities that have been created by those purchases. The assets held in the SOMA portfolio have fixed coupon rates that reflect longer-term interest rates. However, the purchases of those assets create reserves in the banking system, and the Federal Reserve pays interest on those reserves at a short-term interest rate that it controls. The interest paid on reserves can be thought of as the funding cost of the portfolio. Today, because short-term interest rates are low relative to longer-term interest rates, this mismatch produces a very elevated stream of net income. In particular, the SOMA portfolio has a weighted average coupon yield of about 3.5%, which, if applied to a $2.6 trillion portfolio, produces about $90 billion of income at an annualized rate. In contrast, the annualized funding cost of the portfolio at this time is only around $4 billion. This cost is relatively low because of the near zero level of the interest rate paid on reserves. In addition, the private sector holds nearly $1 trillion of currency, which are liabilities of the Federal Reserve that bear no interest. Thus, the SOMA portfolio should produce a considerable amount of net income over the near term. And indeed, for those same reasons, the SOMA has already realized a large amount of income over the past 2 years associated with the asset purchases. Beyond the near term, though, the income that will be produced by the SOMA portfolio is uncertain. If short-term interest rates were to rise, the funding cost of the portfolio would increase relative to the fairly steady yield earned on the assets held, reducing the amount of net income from the portfolio. In addition, if longer-term yields were to move higher, the Federal Reserve could realize capital losses if it were to begin selling assets. However, even if interest rates did move up abruptly and the SOMA portfolio experienced realized losses, it would have no meaningful operational consequences for the Federal Reserve's ability to implement monetary policy. These losses would not impair the FOMC's ability to control short-term interest rates by paying interest on reserves or by draining reserves as needed. Accordingly, the Federal Reserve would continue to operate in the same manner that it otherwise would have in pursuing its economic mandate. What would be affected by unexpectedly large realized losses on the SOMA portfolio would be our remittances to the Treasury. All Federal Reserve earnings in excess of those needed to cover operating costs, pay dividends, and maintain necessary capital levels are remitted to the U.S. Treasury on a weekly basis. Accordingly, any change to the income of the SOMA portfolio directly affects the amount of funds that the Federal Reserve remits to the Treasury. The unusually large amount of portfolio income realized of late has boosted those remittances considerably, But if portfolio income were to decline going forward, whether towards more normal levels or toward unusually low levels, the amount of those remittances would adjust lower. While the potential risks around the SOMA portfolio will not hamper the implementation of monetary policy, the size and duration of the portfolio will have to be taken into account when considering the appropriate policy strategy. In that regard, it is worth noting that even as the Federal Reserve has been expanding its balance sheet, it has not lost any momentum in the preparation of its exit tools. When the FOMC eventually determines that the time to begin reducing policy accommodation has come, the critical tool will be the ability to pay interest on reserves. As has been discussed on many occasions, paying interest on reserves will allow the FOMC to control the cost of short-term credit, even with an enlarged Federal Reserve balance sheet. In addition, we continue to make considerable progress increasing our capacity to drain reserves if necessary. At this time, more than 500 depository institutions have registered for the term deposit facility. Those firms in aggregate hold nearly $600 billion of the reserve balances that are currently in the financial system. We also have added 58 money market funds as counterparties for reverse repurchase agreements, in addition to the 20 primary dealers that are our regular counterparties. Those money funds currently hold more than $1.5 trillion of assets, with a good portion of those assets in the type of short-term repurchase agreements that we would be offering. In short, we have already established considerable capacity to drain reserves with these two tools, and we will continue to advance them in productive directions. Lastly, the FOMC could also remove policy accommodation by halting the reinvestment of maturing assets or by selling assets that are held in the SOMA portfolio, as noted by Chairman Bernanke in last week's press conference. Okay, let me briefly conclude. My purpose today was to provide information on the manner in which the desk has conducted the asset purchases that the FOMC has decided to pursue and the associated implications for financial markets and for the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. On the whole, I believe that the recent asset purchases by the Federal Reserve have had helpful effects on financial conditions and have been implemented in a manner that has been flexible enough to avoid any significant negative consequences for the functioning of financial markets. Moreover, while the programs have resulted in significant changes to the characteristics of the SOMA portfolio, those changes will not impede the ability of the Federal Reserve to adjust the degree of policy accommodation when judged appropriate by the FOMC. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have you got your water set up there? So you're going to take a few questions?
I can, sure.
So time to grill them or barbecue them, whichever we do down
here.
All
right, bring it on.
If you have questions, do we have microphones out? We do. Okay, so I see one way back in the middle there. It would be hard to reach. David's probably got a question. Yeah.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, I mean, in a nutshell, what you said is that from August through November, and then from November until now, the market bought the rumor and sold the fact in terms of the behavior of the bond market, that before QE2 started, bonds rallied and have sold off since. But if we extrapolate that and if we parse the market's belief that there won't be a QE3 after June, what happens next? I mean, is there a danger that we shoot past the August levels in terms of long-term Treasury yields? And if that happens, I mean, do you think that the economy is strong enough to handle it?
So I think I would resist the notion that what we've seen is just buy the rumor, sell the fact. I think the buy the rumor part is right. Certainly markets anticipate what's going to happen. There were a lot of communications from mid-August through early November that suggested that the FOMC was moving in this direction. And I think the markets very appropriately priced in those actions in advance. But I would resist saying then that what happened after that was just sell the fact, because that makes it sound like nothing else happened. And I think something else very important did happen, which is we saw a real turn in the economic data, and there's a lot more confidence in the markets that we are seeing the beginnings of a sustained and more robust recovery. And I think that really is a large part of what's happened in financial markets since then. And one way you can see that is, the buying the rumor part, we saw real interest rates fall. We saw equity prices rise in response. So let's just take those two. If it was just a reversal of that, well, as real interest rates went up, we should have seen equity prices come down. And that's not at all what we've seen. We've seen equities continue to move up in a very robust way. And so again, I think that pattern of rising yields and rising equity prices and narrowing spreads suggests it really has been a revision to the economic outlook that has that has driven the price action since early November. Now, what that means for QE3, I think, is a little different. So I look back on QE2. We don't tend to use that term, but everyone else does, so I'll use that term, and think that it had benefits and that it helped, as I said in the speech. I think, the issue for the prospect of an additional round of asset purchases would be calibrating whether that's appropriate, given the shift in the economic outlook. And this is where that important distinction between the FOMC and the desk comes in. I certainly don't want to comment on whether further asset purchases are appropriate. I mean, that's an FOMC decision.
Okay, any other questions? While we get the microphone around, one concern you hear about QE2 is that while you create a lot of liquidity, you also keep yields very low, so the money doesn't show up here. It shows up in Brazil or some other country. Got any insights you can offer on that?
Well, that's right. I think under the portfolio balance theory, the idea is that the purchase is lower, the risk-free rate structure, in particular the real inflation-adjusted risk-free rate structure, and investors therefore seek other assets. Now, they could seek risky domestic assets, which is part of the story for why corporate bonds rally and equities rally, and that supports economic growth. Or, as you suggest, they could seek assets abroad, and then the effect would come more through the dollar, because as they did that, those currencies would strengthen relative to the dollar. So I see all that as part of the transmission mechanism of asset purchases.
Okay, thank you. Where have we got? Where's the microphone? There we go.
Brian, over the last couple of years, you've done some very good research that many of us have appreciated on the effects of movements in the Fed's portfolio on interest rates. And I noticed that you were saying that rates are lower than they otherwise would be because you're doing the QE. Have you continued with that type of research and made any estimates? I mean, rates have already gone up, but how much higher would they have been had you not been doing the QE? Are you continuing to do that type of research, and do you have any results?
So we did the one research paper looking at the effects of the earlier asset purchase program. I'm not pursuing any additional research projects in part because we're very busy with other things. I think if that research paper, had a range of estimates, but a lot of them centered on this, 50 to 60 basis point effect from the entire first round of asset purchases, which, roughly translates to something, on the order of, 3 basis points per $100 billion. I think in anticipation of the more recent portfolio expansion, we actually saw yield movements that looked somewhat bigger than that relative to the $600 billion. But it was very hard to gauge because I think the market for a time really thought that the Fed was likely to go beyond $600 billion. And it's kind of hard to measure just how far beyond, but certainly numbers of a trillion and a trillion and a half and so on were widely discussed in the markets. So it's a little bit hard to calibrate whether that more recent evidence, looked exactly proportional to the earlier evidence. But I think generally it was close enough. It didn't make us, you know, change our earlier estimates in response to that evidence. So that's, you know, that's a benchmark that I keep in mind. It's oversimplified. You know, the effect on the markets from a certain amount of purchases depends on a lot of things, such as, you know, how long the assets are likely to be held, the condition of markets when the purchases were implemented, and so on. But as a benchmark rule of thumb, that's one that I use at least.
Thank you.
Okay, where's our microphone? Have we got it in place? Somebody, there's. Here it comes to somebody.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for coming down once again. This is helpful. I know it's not the Phillies, but the Flyers are in town tomorrow night. You know, if you happen to be here for the day. You talked a little bit about the realized losses that you may have if the Fed sells assets. Presumably, you're buying some of these bonds above par, and there's either some unrealized losses currently on the book, or you've had some when those bonds have matured. Can you talk at all about how that affects the remittance payments to the Treasury? And kind of a second part question on that is there was recently an accounting change, I guess, at the Fed where they're no longer going to be, the losses won't be booked against capital, they would be booked against the liabilities to the Treasury. And maybe you can help us to understand the math on that as well.
Okay. So in terms of the remittances to Treasury, they're tied to income. And so it's only realized gains or losses that would be transmitted into income, and that would directly affect those remittances. Now, of course, you can also ask, well, what does the unrealized profit or loss in the portfolio look like? And I think that would be a measure of related to the idea that if the FOMC decided to sell off the portfolio in a more rapid manner, kind of, you know, what the income effect could be. Of course, it would only be selling off a portion of the portfolio, even in that extreme case, because we need a portfolio, as I said, of $1 trillion just to match the currency liability. But so I think that's you know, that's how to think of the unrealized P&L on the portfolio. And if there are unrealized losses, presumably, you know, they will be realized over time if the FOMC were to sell the assets or as interest rates kind of run their course. You know, today, and so there may be, you know, some interest, you know, in this given what we've seen take place in rate markets, the big increase in interest rates. And basically, you know, we were carrying the portfolio at a very large unrealized gain, you know, through last fall. And of course, the recent rise in interest rates has reduced that. Even as of late January, you know, we're carrying the portfolio at an unrealized gain across all three asset classes that we hold. The accounting change essentially is a way of, you know, determining the pattern of remittances to the Treasury. So a couple things changed, is my understanding. I'm not an accountant, but one thing that changed in January of this year is the timing of those remittances. So that accounting of determining the remittances to the Treasury now is taking place on a weekly basis and is reported in the H-4-1. So it's kind of, you know, before that it was done, there was a kind of a catch-up on an annual basis, and now that's happening kind of in much more real time and should be transparent on the H-4-1. But another issue that was discussed in all this is, you know, well, what happens, what is that accounting treatment if remittances actually go all the way to zero? And that you know, caused a lot of discussion in the markets. The way the accounting works, if remittances, so if enough losses were realized to push remittances all the way to zero, what happens is an accounting entry gets created, which is like a deferred credit asset, essentially. And all it does, it's a mechanism by which that recognizes that what will happen is the Federal Reserve will use what would have been future remittances to essentially reestablish its capital. So it's a way of just accounting for what happens in that case. One thing to realize is that what the accounting doesn't let the Federal Reserve do is build a capital base. So I mentioned in my speech that we've had a lot of realized income from the enlarged SOMA portfolio. So if you look at 2009 and 2010, the excess net interest from the SOMA portfolio that we realize is something on the order of $55 to $60 billion. We don't build a buffer with that. We just remit that to the Treasury. So then if that income were to swing, we need a mechanism to kind of build the capital back up. And so the way it gets smoothed is not by building a capital buffer ex ante, but by kind of making up the ground ex post, if that's clear.
I see why I got a C in accounting. Mr. Kotok. Here comes Jillian. So if you want to ask a question, we're going to take one or two more. Get your hand up. We got a microphone right there. Okay, thanks. Yeah,
Brian. Right now, we see Fed funds at about 8 basis points, reserve deposit rate at 25. The FDIC is about to change the assessment. That'll drive Barclays' estimate is the 8 basis points on Fed funds may go to 5 or 6 because of that change. I know you're familiar with that. And we have GSEs, which are likely to be net sellers of Fed funds as far as we can see to the horizon, and we don't know what's coming with their liquidation, but it's certainly they're not going to expand portfolios, so they're going to be net sellers all the time. Do you visualize Fed funds eventually restored to the corridor where the reserve deposit rate is the bottom, penalty rate the top, and Fed funds in the middle, or is there some other form coming off reserve deposits, and Fed funds are essentially an antique?
The answer is I don't know what regime we're heading for. there are various options. As you noted, there's an option where interest on reserves is intended to be some kind of floor. We have a ceiling through the discount window, and we let the market, we drain enough reserves to let the market kind of look the way it used to look in terms of intermediating overnight credit and keeping the federal funds rate near a target level that would be between those two levels. But in some versions of that, essentially we need to take the amount of excess reserves all the way back to it's close to where it used to be. Other alternatives are to leave a system in place with more excess reserves and have the target rate be closer to the floor or to the interest rate on reserves. Very important policy issue, one that there hasn't, that to my knowledge, been a lot of communication on from the FOMC, and it'd be hard for me to say much until we have more communication. So I think that's an open issue, and I think as the world renormalizes and as policy tightening comes into play and things like draining reserves emerge as policy issues, I think that framework question is one that the FOMC is going to have to define.
Phil, should this be my last question? Yeah, it should be. There it is.
The morning Wall Street Journal carried the story that the Treasury would shortly have a proposal for reducing the support of mortgages issued by Freddie and Fannie. Can you comment on the relationship between that program and your program?
There is no relationship. I think the Congress and the administration are pursuing reform of the GSEs. They are making very important considerations about what the future of mortgage finance in the U.S. should look like. The reports in the press suggest that they're considering a range of options from, you know, a fully privatized system to a system where there is some kind of government guarantee or government support. And I think they'll make that decision based on how they see the relative merits of that in a way that doesn't have anything to do with what we're doing. Now, it matters to us in the sense we own a lot of agency MBS, and so what happens, you know, to that market affects our balance sheet. But I would imagine that no matter what decisions are made about the future of mortgage finance, they're going to be very careful about, you know, the transition to that new stage and the implications for the existing market. Very complicated issue. I think, you know, there's, you know, widespread opinion that the old system had many problems, that if the government is involved in mortgage finance, it should be it should be more remote, that there should be more private capital put at risk, and any government participation could be more remote, could be you know, priced more appropriately than it was under the old system. But exactly what that means for the markets and for what these credit instruments look like remains to be seen. So I think we'll get a Treasury report soon, and hopefully that'll start to lay out some of the options and open up the discussion, you know, in the public.
Brian, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.